We have so far gone through the first seven chapters. And as you look at what is happening in Revelation, you see that there is a lot of disbelief in the world at the time when these judgments begin to come, just as there is now. To me, it's an amazing thing that this world has no idea about the judgments of God. Have you ever thought about that when you talk to people? When you share the gospel with an unbelieving person and you see that there is a total, just absolutely not even comprehending about what's going to happen when that judgment comes. And sometimes you talk to people, you know, you talk to them about the gospel, and instead of, you know, receiving, instead of submitting to what God says is going to happen, they reject it. It's amazing that men put so much confidence in, you know, things that other people say, you know, like the news reporters, the newspaper, the TV people. You know, they believe what the guy says on the TV, but they won't believe what God says in His Word, you know? That's a strange thing, that people wouldn't believe the testimony that God gives. And what is most tragic is that when they do this, they really do so to their own destruction, because for those who reject Christ, there is no second choice. If you reject Christ, it's going to be a day of judgment. And it will be too late at that point, you see, because that time is going to come very suddenly. When Christ returns to take His church out of this world, that is going to set the stage for the judgments that begin right then. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5, he said, the day of the Lord will come just like what? Like a thief in the night. He says it's going to come suddenly and it's going to catch the world unexpectedly. And if the people that go into that tribulation period, as you see in the book of Revelation, it's going to be a horrible, horrible time. Now, so far what we have seen in the book of Revelation is this flow of events. Chapter 1 is the first major division of Revelation. It's the vision of the resurrected Christ, a vision of Christ in glory. Chapters 2 and 3 form the second main division of Revelation. It is a letter given to seven specific churches in Asia Minor at that time. Seven specific churches. Chapter 1 is the vision of Christ. Chapter 2 is a message to the seven churches. And then beginning in chapter 4, going all the way into chapter 22, you have the futuristic portion of the book. You have the prophecies of the future events that will be coming upon this earth. And in this right now, we have been learning about the structure of the future portion of the book. It consists of seven seal judgments, seven trumpet judgments, and seven bowl judgments. The seals are on a scroll, and the scroll is something that Christ has taken out of the hand of God the Father, Revelation chapter 5 says, and this scroll that He is holding has seals on the edge. The seal was there to prevent people from tampering with the contents and from opening. And so every time that Christ takes this, when He takes the scroll, He opens up one of the seals, and the scroll is unfolded a little bit further. You open a seal, and it is opened up further. And each one of those seals represents an outpouring of God's judgment. Each one of them is an outpouring of God's judgment. Now, when you come to the last seal, the seventh seal, what happens is the seventh seal opens, and it opens up a series of seven trumpet judgments. So there's kind of a telescoping effect that takes place. But in each one of these judgments, it is an outpouring of God's wrath upon an unsaved world. Now, in chapter 6, where we were at a couple weeks ago, chapter 6 is what shows us the first six seals. The first six seals. Chapter 7 is really a parenthetical chapter. Chapter 7 is kind of giving you a behind-the-scenes look at some of the things that are taking place. It does not advance the chronology of the judgments. It is parenthetical. We know that because when you come to chapter 8 in verse 1, it says that the seventh seal was opened. So everything in chapter 7 is kind of an interlude or a parenthetical chapter showing us the 144,000 as well as this great multitude in heaven. Chapter 8 then is the beginning of the seventh seal. And the seventh seal then issues forth into seven trumpet judgments. Tonight, as we begin learning about the trumpet judgments, we're going to see the entrance of these judgments, the execution of them, and then the escalation. We're going to look in chapter 8 this morning in its entirety, and I want you to read it with me as we go through the text. Chapter 8, verse 1, it says that when He broke the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God,
and seven trumpets were given to them. And another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, with the prayers of the saints, went up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer, and he filled it with the fire of the altar, and he threw it to the earth. And there followed peals of thunder, sounds and flashings of lightning, and an earthquake. And the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. And the first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. They were thrown to the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. And the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten, so that a third of them might be darkened, and the day might not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. And I looked, and I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." Verses 1 to 5 show us really the entrance of the trumpet judgments. It's setting the scene or the context for these seven judgments. And what you see in verses 1 to 5 are three points of preparation. There are three points of preparation that John shows us before the actual trumpets can begin to be poured out. Now you see here in verse 1 that the angel takes this seventh seal. And it says here that there was silence in heaven for about a half an hour. The question arises, why was there silence in heaven? Why was there silence in heaven? Well, a number of ideas have been suggested. Now, I'm going to give you one of them, okay? And I'm not saying I hold this view. I'm just saying this is what one person suggested. They said because there's no women in heaven, so you have silence for half an hour. No, that's not true. Nobody even said that. And my wife is giving me a dirty look right now, so I'm sorry. Okay. There was no men in heaven. How's that? There was no football games in heaven for half an hour. How's that? No, but you have this silence, and you say, well, why in the world is that? Well, one of the ideas that has been suggested is that this is actually the beginning of the millennial kingdom. The answer to that is no. The millennium doesn't start until the end of this whole period. Another view that has been suggested is that there is just a pause in judgment. Somebody else has suggested that it is a pause in the revelation being made known. Some have suggested it's a pause in the prayers themselves. That the prayers that have been being given, like in chapter 6, verse 10, that the prayers are being answered in this time period. But I think that the best solution for this, and the Bible doesn't say exactly why, is it's a pause to make an impact upon the dramatic things that are about to take place. You know, sometimes, have you ever seen, for example, when somebody brings a verdict out of a courtroom, and, what do they call the guy at the head of the jury? The jury foreman comes out, and he stands there. And you know what? It's very, very quiet because the verdict is about to be set forth. And this is the kind of the idea right here, is that something very, very bad is about to happen to this world. Now, in all of the other judgments, when you look at the six seal judgments, as you open each seal, immediately there is a judgment. Seal opens, immediately a judgment. Seal, immediately a judgment. After this seventh seal, you do not have a judgment that immediately comes forth. The reason why is because, number one, of the seriousness of what is about to take place, but also it is because of the fact that seventh seal in itself is not a judgment. It contains the trumpet judgments. The trumpets then begin after that, and so the trumpets are the judgments. The seventh seal is what contains the seven trumpets. And so you have silence in heaven for this time period because of the dread and because of the awe that is about to happen. Something very, very serious is about to take place. Now, in terms of the chronology, we would place this opening of the seventh seal right at the middle of the seven-year tribulation period, right about the middle of that seven-year tribulation period. The rapture hits. The church is taken out of the world. You've got 3.5 years of judgments that take place in chapter 6 of Revelation. The six seals take place in the first 3.5 years. Now you have come to the midpoint of the tribulation period. You've come to the midpoint of the tribulation period. And the question has been asked, well, what else is happening at this time period? You know, in other words, what's the context of what's taking place on earth? Well, we know that as soon as the rapture occurs, there is going to be an individual arise on the earth who comes into power. We call him commonly the Antichrist. The Antichrist. Now, some people have wondered, well, how could it be that one man could gain control over this world block of world power? The Antichrist, the Bible tells us, is going to gain control of a world empire. Do you know how Adolf Hitler got into office? Huh? He was elected in. Yeah, he was voted in. And do you know, it's interesting, just a couple days ago, it was in 1934, just 2 days ago, that there was a, now I've never even heard this word before, but a plebiscite. I guess that's like a maybe a voting body. A plebiscite in Germany approved the vesting of the sole executive power in Adolf Hitler. Just a couple days ago in ancient history, in 1934, was the time period when the world said to Adolf Hitler, Germany said to Adolf Hitler, we give you the whole kit and caboodle. You have all the power. The Bible says that in the end times, that there's going to be this charismatic individual who arises that gets control of all of the power of a reunited Roman Empire. Basically, the reunified Western Europe is going to come together, and they are going to put their allegiance to the Antichrist. It says this in chapter 17 of Revelation. In verse 13, it says, all of these nations, they give, have one purpose, and that is to give their power and authority to the beast. Now, when the Antichrist comes into his power, the first thing that is going to happen in a public scene or in a public setting where you could identify who he is that the Antichrist is going to establish a 7-year covenant involving the nation of Israel. A 7-year covenant that involves the nation of Israel. We read about that in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. I saw another article a couple days ago. I'm not sure what day it was, about 2 days ago as well, where it says that Ehud Barak, their president of or the prime minister of Israel, he said that he would agree to creation of a Palestinian state if the Palestinians would end their conflict. Now, you know, what's happening is that something is brewing in Israel right now. For a long time, Israel said, no way, Palestinians can't stay here. No way, we're not going to give them any land. Well, they've been giving them land. The Palestinians say, no, we want to have a state. We want Jerusalem as our capital. And the Jews kept saying, no, no, no. Well, what's happening is that more and more Israel is bowing under pressure, and Barak has said, okay, we'll allow them to have statehood. And the Palestinians want to have Jerusalem as their capital. I don't know exactly how all these things are going to work, and nobody really can say dogmatically how it's going to have its outworking, but I can tell you this, that we do know that one political military leader in the world is going to come to prominence, and he is going to be the one who establishes a 7-year covenant involving Israel and Israel's enemies. And my friends, it's right around the corner. I don't know how close, but it's close. It is very, very close. And that means, my friends, that the rapture of the Church of Jesus Christ is like that far away, okay? Like that far away. Who knows? Could be tomorrow. Could be 5. Could be 10 years. I don't know. But it's close. And when that happens, it's going to begin that 7-year period of time. Now, we also know that 7-year time period is broken into 2 segments. The first 3.5 years, when that covenant is made, the Antichrist holds his part of the bargain. And he allows Israel to reinstitute their temple sacrifices, which right now there's a big problem, because the Temple Mount, where they would put their temple, is occupied by something called the Dome of the Rock.
That whole mount right there, the Temple Mount, is occupied by the Palestinians. Well, what's going to happen is that in that covenant, Israel is going to obtain the right to begin their sacrificial system again. Okay, so that happens at the beginning of that 7-year time period. But in the middle of that 7-year time period, we know from Daniel 9:27 that in the middle of that time period, the Antichrist breaks his covenant that he made, and he does not allow Israel to have their sacrifices any longer. He breaks the covenant, and he turns against Israel to begin persecuting Israel. Something else that is very significant happens at that time period as well. If you know Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39 talk about an invasion that comes from the far north, an invasion that comes against Israel. Commentators are varied in terms of when they would place that invasion. But there is a good reason to think that that invasion comes at the midpoint of the 7-year tribulation period. Good reason to believe that it happens right around the midpoint of that tribulation period. And if so, that means that you're going to have this coalition of powers coming in to attack Israel at the middle of that tribulation period. You know, Russia, and we don't know if it's Russia or not. It could involve Russia. How many of you have heard of a guy by the name of Vladimir Zhirinovsky? They call him Mad Vlad because this guy is nuts. I mean, he, you know, just says, hey, you know, we'll start a war, we'll, you know, send nukes on you guys. He's just a crazy guy, and he's very anti-Semitic as well. And I guess Kevin was telling me that he's written a book. And in this book, he talks about going and invading Palestine, going and invading Israel. It's going to happen. We don't know exactly how these things are going to work, but it's going to happen. There's going to be an invasion that comes against Israel. All these things are right at the middle of the 7-year tribulation period. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24, verse 15, that the Antichrist, when he breaks this covenant, he is going to go into the Jewish holy place, into the Jewish temple, and that he is going to set himself up as a person to be worshipped. It says that he sets up the abomination of desolation, and that he actually goes into the Jewish Holy of Holies, and he demands worship for himself, and more than likely will place some kind of an image or statue of himself in that Holy of Holies, so that he is receiving praise and worship instead of God. All these things are happening right at the middle of this tribulation period. Now you come down here to verse 2, and John sees something else. He sees seven angels who stand before God. In the book of Enoch, it's called First Enoch. It's not in the Bible. It's a non-inspired book. But in the book of First Enoch, it talks about the seven archangels. I met a guy yesterday whose name is Uriel. And I said, hey, you know what your name means? And he says, well, yeah, it's one of the archangels. And in that book, First Enoch, that's where this comes from, is these seven archangels. We don't know if there are seven archangels or not. Really, the only two that we know of are Michael and Gabriel. It's possible that these seven angels that are spoken of right here are archangels, but that would be speculation. Well, all we know is that there are seven specific angels, and it says that these angels, they stand in the presence of God. And it also says that seven trumpets were given to them. Trumpets were used for a number of purposes in Israel. You would blow a trumpet if you were going to assemble everybody for battle. They had a certain kind of sound they would make, you know, a certain song they would play. Some trumpets were used to call people together for great festivals that they had every year in Jerusalem. There were different uses for the trumpets, but these angels have these seven trumpets pointing to something big, something real big is about to happen. In verses 3 to 5, we see another point, a third of preparation. It says down here that there is an angel with a golden censer. Now, a censer was, sometimes they called it a fire pan. It was like this pan, and you could take, and you could put incense in it, and then you could bring that, and you could pour the incense upon the coals of the fire on the altar of incense. They had an altar of incense that used to stand in the Jewish temple, also back in the tent called the tabernacle of the Old Testament. You had the tabernacle, and then that was replaced later on by Solomon's temple. And right in front of the Holy of Holies, you had this altar of incense. And the way it would work is that you had coals of fire that were put on the altar, coals of fiery coals, and then you would take and you would add the incense onto the altar. And this angel, it says here, is holding a golden censer, like it was in the Old Testament. And it says that much incense was given to him so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints upon the altar, which is before the throne. Now, you see this altar mentioned a couple times. If you look back in chapter 6, for example, you see in chapter 6 in verse 9, it says that there are these souls who had been slain because of the word of God, and they're under the altar. And if you look over here in chapter 8 in verse 5, it is mentions again the altar, that fire was put onto the altar. You can see it in chapter 9 in verse 13. The sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four corners of the golden altar, which is before the throne. Chapter 9 verse 14, you see it again. Chapter 9 verse 18. Let's see, not in chapter 9 verse 18. Forgive me, that's not right there. You also see it later on in chapter 16, I think, over in verse 7, if I remember correctly. Yes, I heard the altar saying, "Yes, O Lord God the Almighty." So you've got a number of mentions here of this altar. And the question has to be, what is its purpose? You know, you've got this altar now. In the Old Testament temple, you had this altar of incense, and they would put the incense on it. It says down here that what they do is that they are taking and they are putting incense on, and it is mixing with the prayers of the saints. The picture is this. What God is doing in symbolic form is He is showing the way that He is going to execute His wrath upon sin. You see, the people who are getting persecuted, the believers that are getting put to death, are praying and they're saying, "God, how long until you bring a judgment?" Look back in chapter 6 at verse 10. You have these people who have been killed under the altar in verse 9, killed because they were believers, and verse 10 says, they cried out with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood upon those who dwell on the earth?" God, how long until you judge these people? Hey, they've been killed. They've been put to death for their faith. And they are praying. Now, the picture that we see is that as you take this incense, and the incense in the Old Testament was made up of four spices, and it was seen as being so holy that it could not be used for any common, ordinary use. It was only used in the temple, and it was added on the altar of incense, and then the incense would come up as smoke. And symbolically, it was going up before God Himself. Here, as John sees in heaven this taking place, he sees the incense added, he says, to the coals, and he says it is mixed in association with the prayers. So it's a symbolic picture of the way that the prayers of these martyrs are now coming up before God. In other words, the idea is that it is time for God to bring a judgment in answer to the prayers of His people. God is going to bring a judgment in answer to the prayers of His people. And it is symbolized by this incense being added to the coals, and then it is being mixed with the prayers and going up. Well, if you look down here in verse 5, it says that this angel takes the censer, he picks it back up. This time he fills it with fire from the altar. So the prayers are going up before God, the prayers for vengeance and vindication. Now the angel takes this this fire pan, and he puts some coals on it, and then he comes and he casts it to the earth. The word, it says, throws it here, but the word is cast. It means to hurl it down, and he's going to throw it down to the earth. The result of it is you see disturbances all over the earth. It says that there were thunder, peals of thunder, and lightning, and sounds, and an earthquake. Something's happening, something really, really bad. I'll give you a little footnote, though. Look at verse 5, and you see how it talks about the peals of thunder, and the sounds of lightning, and the earthquake. Look with me at chapter 11 for just one second, in chapter 11 and verse 19. It says, "The temple of God which is in heaven was open, and the ark of His covenant appeared in His temple, and there were flashes of lightning, sounds, peals of thunder, and an earthquake, and a great hailstorm." Also, look in chapter 16 with me for just one second. In chapter 16, in verse 18, you see another similar picture where it says that... chapter 16 over here. Chapter 16, verse 18, it says, "There were flashes of lightning, sounds and peals of thunder, and there was a great earthquake, such had not come since man came to be upon the earth." Okay, you see a similar pattern here. And the reason why you see a similar pattern is because at the end of each one of these sequences, at the end of the seven seals, at the end of the seven trumpets, and at the end of the seventh bowl, you see this earthquake and this conflict and these judgments and these firestorms. But they are not parallel. The reason why I point that out to you right now is to tell you that these things are not parallel. In other words, it's not all happening at the same time. This is all sequential. But at the end of each one of these series of judgments, at the end of the seventh seal, trumpet, and bowl, you find a similar kind of what's called a storm theophany. It's a great conflict where God appears in His wrath as this great stormy kind of situation. But it is not parallel. They are all sequential. Well, the point that it is getting to is this, is that the time period has intensified for God's wrath to be executed. And this is what we see in verses 6 to 12, is the execution of the seven trumpet judgments. And each one of them, as you're going to notice, we're going to look at the first four today, each one of these judgments has a specific target. The first target is earth itself. In chapter 8 and verse 7, it says, "The first angel sounded, and there came forth hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees, and a third of all," or not a third, but all the green grass was burned up. The first target is upon earth itself. And he describes the judgment here in verse 7. He says that there was hail and fire mixed with blood. Now you're going to find something in these sealed, in these trumpet judgments. The first four trumpet judgments bear resemblance to the judgments that came back in the time period of the Exodus. Back in Exodus chapters 7, 8, 9, and 10, when God brought the judgments upon the Egyptians, there are a lot of similarities between them. And it says here that you had hail coming down. There was an article in the paper just recently. I thought this was pretty interesting. It says that an elderly woman claimed she was hit by a falling ice ball. Apparently the first victim of a phenomenon that has been puzzling scientists. Juana Sanchez, age 70, said she was knocked out briefly by a large frozen object that hit her on the shoulder as she walked near her home in Almeria in southern Spain. And scientists are studying a dozen specimens. 30 chunks of ice are said to have dropped from sky since January 8th, the same size of basketballs, some the size of basketballs, and often in sunny weather. And almost every region has been hit. Interesting. You know, when you get to Revelation 16, you know how big those hail stones are? 100 pounds. Revelation 16, 100-pound hail stones coming down. Now, I don't know how big that would be. What, like maybe about like this big or something? Imagine a bag of ice. 50 pounds is about like that, right? A big hail stone as big as a massive ball, beach ball or something, crashing down on you. This is not the tribulation period, by the way. I'm not suggesting this is the tribulation period. But lest you think that this kind of thing cannot happen, listen, there is a God in heaven who judges sin. And this hail that is coming down, I don't know exactly how it works, to tell you the truth. Hail and fire that is mixed with blood. The mixing with blood more than likely is describing the effect of the hail when it hits the earth and you have all of this human life that is being affected by it and animal life. You know, blood being mixed in through the judgment. But how it is that you have hail and fire coming down, it's hard to say. It is possible that it would be something like volcanic activity. That you have volcanic activity. And so as the ashes and then the fire is coming down out of volcanoes throughout the world, that you have these hailstones coming down, so you've got hail and fire together coming down. It's hard to say exactly because we have not seen it. But you can see that it does resemble in a certain way the seventh plague in Exodus chapter 9, verse 24. There is similarity to Exodus 9:24. Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 22 describes the judgment that God brings against some of the invasions that come in the tribulation period. When those nations come from the north to invade Israel, it says in Ezekiel 38:22, God says, "With pestilence and blood I will enter into judgment with him, and I will rain upon him and upon his troops and all the peoples a torrential rain with hailstones, fire, and brimstone." That's Ezekiel 38:22. Great judgments coming from heaven. And by the way,
if John is seeing some of these things that are particularly focused upon Israel, and what Ezekiel is picturing is an invasion of Israel, this is what you might be seeing, is the same events happening where this rainstorm of hail and fire is coming down, that it, in particular, it has as its object the people who are unsaved. By the way, look over with me at chapter 9 for just a second. Chapter 9, chapter 9 in verse 15, I think it is. It says that, that's not the verse I wanted. I'll find it here. I'll go up back up further. Chapter 9 in verse 4. This is in the fifth trumpet judgment. It says that these beings, these demons, were told to go out and not hurt grass or the earth, but only men who do not have the seal of God upon their foreheads. You notice here that the particular object of God's wrath is the unsaved, those who don't have the seal of God or the mark of ownership of God. The particular objects who are receiving God's wrath are the unsaved who are living. Well, if you come back here to chapter 8 and verse 7, you see the results of this hail and fire that is coming down. It says that the first angel sounded, and there came down hail and fire, and it was thrown down, and a third of the earth was burned up. A third of the earth, a third of the trees, and all of the green grass. Apparently, there is just this fiery storm that hits upon the earth, and everything is fried. A third of the trees, but all the green grass, because the grass is more sensitive. Some kind of fiery judgment is coming down. A third of the earth. Total incineration. Well, that brings you to here to this second trumpet judgment in verses 8 and 9. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood. What is this? I don't know. Never seen anything like a great mountain burning with fire before. Some people have suggested that it could be a meteorite. You know, a few months ago, back in May, there was a shifting of the constellations. There was an article in the paper that talked about it, how, you know, there was an aligning of the planets, and everybody was afraid that there was going to be maybe massive conflicts on Earth, and there was going to be meteorite showers coming down. It's possible that what you see in verse 8 is something like a massive meteorite coming down against the earth. Another possibility I want to suggest for you is this. It could be some kind of, that John is seeing some kind of contemporary weapons that we have today. John is seeing some kind of military conflict that's taking place when he sees this mountain burning with fire. It could be very possibly nuclear conflicts taking place. We don't know exactly. But the object of this judgment in verse 8 is the sea. The object in verse 7 was the earth. In verse 8, the sea is the particular focus of judgment. And it says that a third of the sea became blood. A third of the sea became blood. We went up to, a couple weeks ago, we went up to Santa Barbara, and then up to, what's that town up there? Solvang. And it was interesting because looking along the coastline was all red. Have you ever seen the coastline get red? I think, do they call it red algae? Is that what it's called? Red tide. Now, from what I understand, that's very high in deadly bacteria. It's possible that when John sees the sea become red, he says that the sea became blood. Some people have suggested that really what it's describing here is that the whole sea has come to have this red tide, and that you're seeing some kind of red tide where the whole thing looks like blood. That's a possibility. I'm not saying it's necessarily it. But remember what happened back in the first plague upon Egypt? What was the first plague that Moses brought upon the Egyptians? Remember what that was back in Exodus chapter 7? The Nile River became what?
Blood.
And it didn't just say that it kind of looked red with a red tide. It became blood. God literally turned the water into blood. He's able to do that. He's able to do that. And this is what we see. We see a parallel between the judgments of the Exodus and the judgments that are coming here. And so the sea became blood. Literally, that's what it says. Is there room for any kind of phenomenological language where he's describing the phenomenon that he sees? It's possible.
But you know what? Very well, it could be that the sea is being turned into blood. And as it says right here, a third of the sea became blood. Also, it says down here in verse 9 that a third of the creatures which were in the sea died. That's a lot of fish. That's a lot of fish. That's a lot of whales. That's a lot of everything else. A third of the creatures died. And he also says here that a third of the ships were destroyed. This is cataclysmic. A third of everything dead. You know, when you talk to people, my friends, when you talk to people about Jesus Christ, impress upon them the seriousness of rejecting the gospel. Are you going to offend people? You're going to offend some people. Some people will get offended when you come and warn them about the wrath that is coming to this earth. You might talk to somebody and you might try to be as kind as possible or as nice as possible, but people need to understand what's going to happen. People need to understand that this is going to take place. And if you really love them, you'll be willing to take some heat. If you really love them, you'll be willing to risk. Because how can we not tell people about this? This is our job. This is our job as a Christian, is to be there to tell people about God's love, His mercy through the cross, but to warn them about the wrath that is going to pour out upon mankind. Well, this is what we see. It is God's wrath coming down, devastating the earth. Verses 10 to 11, we come to the third of the trumpet judgments. This time, the target is the fresh waters. Verses 8 and 9 were the seas. Now we have the fresh waters in target. Verse 10 says that the angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. Something like a burning torch comes out of the sky. What is this? I don't know. It could be a meteor. Again, it could be a conventional weapon. It could be a nuclear weapon. It says that this star fell from heaven, and it fell upon a third of the waters and upon the springs of the waters. So fresh waters are being targeted here. Now notice what it says in verse 11. It says that the name of the star is called Wormwood. Opsenthos is the Greek term here. It's only used here in Revelation. Wormwood. Back in the Old Testament, God spoke about bitter waters, about waters that had been polluted and made bitter. In Jeremiah, for example, in chapter 9, verse 15, as God talked about the judgment He would bring on Israel, He said, "I will feed this people with wormwood and give them poisonous water to drink." Wormwood was a very bitter and made water unsuitable, even almost to the point of poisonous. And this star that falls, this burning star that falls and hits the waters, is called Opsenthos, wormwood. Well, something is interesting, okay? You may know this, Olga. Do you know what the word wormwood, how you translate it in Russian? Huh? Yeah, also Chernobyl. The word Chernobyl in Russian is the word wormwood. I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, who knows if there's any kind of connection. But the word Chernobyl means wormwood. In other words, this bitter plant. And I don't know if this is a nuclear kind of exchange that you see being described here, but I think it is quite likely that what you see is you see this burning torch, something like a burning torch falling on the waters. And notice it says the waters became wormwood and people died from drinking the waters because the waters were made bitter. It very well could be that what you see being described here is the nuclear exchange is taking place. The water supplies are getting extremely contaminated with all of the fallout, and the result is that people are dying. This is going to happen. I think it's almost inevitable that you're going to see the nuclear conflicts taking place during that time period. And many people are going to die. People are going to realize that there is a God and God judges sin. Come down here to verse 12. We come to a fourth trumpet judgment. Verse 12. A fourth trumpet judgment. Only this time, it's not the earth, and it's not the sea, and it's not fresh waters, but it's the heavens themselves. It says the angel sounded, and there was a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were smitten. To strike, it means to strike or to hit. This time, the object is the sun, the stars, and the moon. And they were smitten so that a third of them might be darkened, and that they might not shine for a third of it, and the night also in the same way. There's a couple possibilities here. One possibility is that a third of the planets themselves, or a third of the stars, are actually wiped out. So you would count one-third of them numerically and eliminate them because they were smitten. Somehow they were struck. That's a possibility. Another possibility when it says that they did not shine for a third of the day is that it is some kind of partial eclipse. And that what is happening in some way is that the light of them, the light from the sun, the stars, and the moon, is not being permitted to shine for one-third of its time period. Robert Thomas, my Greek professor, in his commentary, holds that that is an adverbial idea, so that it means that one-third of the time is being shortened, one-third of the time that they're shining. How does this take place? I don't know. Nobody's ever seen it before. What exactly is going to happen? Does it mean that the whole universe is going to begin to shake apart and there's going to be a loss of light? Or does it mean, it could mean that because of all the earthquakes and volcanoes on Earth, that you have all of the atmosphere becoming polluted from the volcanoes and from the earthquakes, like at Mount St. Helens or like in the Philippines. And so you have the atmospheres becoming totally polluted, and therefore you're not able to see for one-third of the time. And that, I think, is a very, very possible explanation for what is taking place. It would also help to explain why some of these prophetic passages say that the moon turned like blood. Because what's going to happen is that all the smoke and all the ashes in the skies are going to cause the sun and the moon and the other stars to even look red, like blood. But it's really kind of coming from Earth itself, from all of these things. Well, you know what? It's bad. This is really, really bad. But that brings us to a third and final point, the escalation of the trumpet judgments in verse 13. As bad as everything has been so far, verse 13 says, "And I looked," and whenever John says this, "and I looked," kai eidon, "I looked and I saw," it is introducing another aspect of a vision. It's kind of shifting gears. No longer is he dealing with the trumpet judgment itself, but it's giving you a little bit of an explanation of something. And he says, "And I looked and I saw," and he says, "there was an eagle flying in mid-heaven." Some of your Bibles may say an angel flying in mid-heaven. Some of the later manuscripts that were copied later on had that word angel in it. Probably because they think a scribe thought it made more sense if it was an angel crying out. But the earliest manuscripts say that it was an eagle. And you say, well, that's silly. How can an eagle say anything? Well, remember what happened back in Numbers chapter 22? God spoke to Balaam through what? Through a donkey. And so it's possible, Genesis chapter 3, Satan spoke through a serpent. It's very possible here that you have this eagle flying. There's some kind of symbolical language taking place right here. But John sees this eagle flying in mid-heaven, and he says, "Woe, woe, woe." Now, any time that you see somebody saying, "Woe, woe, woe," what it means is that things are going to get real, real ugly. Real, real ugly. Why? Because so far what you've had is you've had four of these trumpet judgments pass. What has been the object of these trumpet judgments so far? Earth, sea, waters, skies. From now on, the wrath begins to be pointed directly at man. Mankind so far has been being impacted by these judgments. But right now what's going to happen, beginning in chapter 9, is that the judgments are going to turn in focus upon unsaved men. And they are going to also intensify greatly in the final three judgments. The first four are basically parallel as a unit. There's a similarity between the four where they are somewhat parallel. But when we pick up here in chapter 9, you find out that they get very, very, very bad. And it's God's judgment upon an unbelieving world. God's judgment on an unbelieving world. Listen, this is really, really sad stuff, isn't it? I think it is. It's not something to rejoice over where we say, good, you know, I'm going to see people go to hell. No, we don't think that way. We don't think that way at all. And, you know, some people don't even like to hear a message like this where, you know, they say, man, all you're talking about is, you know, fire and brimstone and wrath. Well, guess what? That's what the passage is teaching today. Fire and brimstone and wrath and judgment. Yes, that's what it's teaching. And so we're going to teach it like God said. But it's a very sobering thing for us to think about. Now, as we apply this to ourselves, I think that's what we should do is this. We should realize that there are people, my friend, you're going to see people today, you're going to see people tomorrow
who will burn in hell. And you have an opportunity to take the gospel to them. You can't twist their arm. You can't force them to do something. You cannot make them believe. But you are going to talk to people and see people today, tomorrow, the next day, who are on their way to hell. And it's eternal. And you and I have an opportunity to give them a message that can bring them out of condemnation. Are you ready? If you're in Christ, if you have received Him as Lord and Savior, you are going to be with Christ when He comes to take you at the rapture. But what about the people around you? There are people around you. They're in our family. They live next door to us. And so I think what we need to do is we just need to...